Hi folks, how are you? Welcome along to another episode of my podcast, Soundtracking with Edith Bowman. Thank you so much for choosing to listen to the podcast. I'm actually just home from spending the morning at Ayr Studios, which was a lot of fun. I haven't been there. It's my first time back since pre-lockdown, and they've had a little bit of a refurb, which is very exciting. A new cafe, always lovely cups of tea in there. Bumped into David Arnold, as you do. But I was there to interview Anne Nikitin, the wonderful composer. So you're going to hear that over the next couple of weeks. It's always really inspiring and wonderful to be in those incredible building with all the amazing music that's been made in there over the years. So, looking forward to get back there on a regular occurrence. The Oscars, of course, happened last night. I'm going to focus on the positive. I'm wonderful to see the phenomenal Ariana DeBose, a guest on the show a few weeks back, picking up the Best Actress Award for her phenomenal work in West Side Story. Just so happy for her and so deserved for that fantastic performance. Loads of great people winning awards as well, which is great. So congratulations to all the winners. And that is all I shall say about it for the minute. But our guest on this landmark show, because, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in wishing us a happy 300th birthday. We are celebrating our 300th episode. What? I'm going to do my own little Oscars acceptance speech here as a way of thanking each and every one of you. So thank you first and foremost to our guests for sparing the time to chat to me and allow me to pick their brains about film and music, whether they are a one-time guest on the show or whether, like Ben Wheatley, they've been on five times. I can't thank you enough for just being part of our wonderful celebration of the unique and brilliant relationship that music and film have. Thank you to everybody who helps us facilitate the guests. So all the film companies, the PR companies, the individuals, I really appreciate you helping us out and helping us facilitate some incredible conversation. And thank you to you for listening. Without you and your support, we wouldn't be able to keep this thing going. We're very lucky and grateful that we can, because we love making it. So thank you for listening. Whether you've listened to one episode, a handful, or you have been with us from the very start and are about to dive into episode 300, thank you so, so much. And my biggest personal thanks goes to Ben, who every week on the show just cracks on with it, to be honest. He's a wizard, a wonderful human being, so generous with his time, so committed to the show, and it would not be the show it is without his invaluable support and talent. So Ben, thank you so, so much for everything you do for the show. I really appreciate it. And here's to the next 300 together, I hope. No pressure. But to celebrate our landmark show, I thought this is a really nice way to do this, because the one thing that we've done from the start on the show is to never really have an agenda apart from have a conversation about film and music. Yes, a lot of the time we speak to people around release dates, but we are not dictated to in terms of who we speak to. We might speak to a first-time director. We might speak to someone who's made 100 films and everything in between. We might speak to writers, producers, composers, obviously, music supervisors. And I wanted to celebrate our 300th birthday by speaking to someone about a film that I absolutely loved. I have watched it several times. It is out in cinemas now. It just came out on Friday and it missed out on the Oscar in the Best Foreign Film category, missing out to the Japanese road movie Drive My Car. I am talking about The Worst Person in the World. So I thought it'd be a nice way of celebrating our 300th birthday by celebrating a film that we absolutely love. Joachim Trier has received widespread acclaim for his black comedy drama, which tells the story of Julie as she tries to navigate the troubled waters of her love life and career. And her life, really. And I don't know about you, if you have seen the film already, I saw so much of myself in this character and in this story that I thought it was fantastic. He's done an amazing job. And it also has an astounding soundtrack. So I think we should begin with a cue from the film. This is Polly by Daphne. Thank you. start at the beginning in terms of what was the seed of the idea for first of all writing The Worst Person in the World and then obviously going on to direct this extraordinary film?
Thank you. No, I wanted to do like a love story. Mm. But obviously love is not easy. So I wanted to try to find a way to talk honestly about it. And I was together with Eskil Fock, my co-writer, I guess we were sort of ambivalent or rather inspired by two directions. On one hand, we wanted to try our hand at lighter romantic comedic elements and have fun with it. Yeah. And make it joyful and sensuous and playful. On the other hand, we grow up one country over from Bergman, you know, like so scenes from A Marriage and that kind of the generational take on how love feels difficult in specific ways right now between, in this case, two generations in a way, because there's a bit of an age gap in the first relationship that we're viewing in the film. So it's a mixture of light and heavy. We wanted to try to find some truth in between that.
There's so much truth in it. That's what I think I found so connectable about the film, you know, in terms of both sides of all the relationships. You could kind of see your own experiences in so both sides of Julie, this incredible character that you just fall in love with her immediately. You're kind of like, yes, I am with you kind of wherever you go. And when you were writing it, the idea of kind of pouring your own experiences of love lost, you know, love kind of not the right time, the right place sort of thing. There's an abundance that kind of, I imagine that you could have both sort of thrown in there, but making it seem so real and carving that out, was that an easy thing to do in terms of the stories to the stories and the situations to have her go through, really, I guess?
Oh, wow. Thank you for that. I don't think making films is easy. It's always a struggle. But I think what's fun about it is the combination that. So to break it down a bit, on one hand, I felt when I was in my 30s a while back that I was sort of the Norwegian champion of heartbreak in my own life. Like I had a hard time figuring it out. I met some wonderful people and we're many of them I'm friends with today. You know, it's a good thing to look back on. I learned a lot, but it's hard. It's hard to negotiate intimacy and life choices, and it becomes quickly very existential.
Yeah.
And I remember having this thought quite early on that I told Eskil that I feel, and pardon, forgive me for sounding a bit intellectual, but it was me trying to analyze our perception of love in cinema. So we are often told that it's about essence in terms of finding the right one, and then everything will be fine. In my life, I think the factor of timing has often played in weird ways. Like, I've been with someone who was at a different juncture in their life or wanted something else. I've been both the person who did not want children because I felt that I needed to be a filmmaker. And then I've been the person later on who wanted children and been with someone who was younger than me and ambitious and said, I can't deal with this right now. You know, like, so I've been on both sides of the fence, and I'm in my 40s now. And I feel I have enough experience to try to do a humanist take on that, where I can not make anyone an antagonist, but try to understand them all, which is obviously the dynamic we want when we write drama. Because I feel that a lot of the pain that we go through in life, in families, in relationships, in friendships, no one has any bad intentions. It's just really, really hard to make it work out. So that as kind of a starting point to make stories, I always find challenging, but more interesting. Yeah. Than just saying, oh, she's going to be with a real asshole of a guy. And obviously the audience is going to want her to get out of that. That would be too easy, you know?
There's a line that she says that I love that I was like, oh, I felt like that, where she says, it's like I'm playing a supporting role in my own life. And it's kind of like, oh man, that's an amazing line. It says so much, really. And I was like, yes, I felt like that.
No, I think that's a very important, that's one of the moments of growth. Like, she's realizing also, like, the film has this structure that it's through loss and grief and pain that we learn. Yeah. Sorry, you know, bad news, everyone. Don't we agree on that? I mean, that's...
Mistakes are a good thing. It's how we grow as better people.
Yeah, exactly. I think so. I think that line that your Julie feels like that. She thought she would... She's brought up to believe she has possibilities. And she's obviously very smart and gifted in many ways, as we see in the film. But she doesn't know how to take that center stage of... And also in terms of self-perception and self-love, the title of the film that some people take very literally is obviously not judging anyone, the worst person in the world. It's meant as a, oh, Jesus, we all feel like failures a lot, don't we? Or at least I do.
When you've got to have that conversation with someone that you've been through a lot with, or you've spent, you know, and you kind of, but you know that's the right conversation to have. And you feel like the worst person in the world. You're not, but you feel like it whilst you're having that conversation. You can see the pain they're going through, all that kind of stuff. So, yeah. Can we talk about music? Because the music in the film is stunning. It's everything from when A-Marie comes on and she's dancing, and then it gets, then it changes, you know, someone comes on and changes it. You're like, no. And then, oh, actually, this is a good tune too. And then,
Simande.
To that beautiful, is it called Ma Mère Loi, Ma Mère Loi, where she freezes time, which I love that moment in the film as well.
The Ravel piece.
And it's so delicate and kind of sort of, it's like a tide kind of comes in and out at times as well. It's just so beautiful. Did you write with music in mind? Did you know how you wanted music to, where you wanted it
to
placed?
Play into it. Yeah. Yeah. No, we Eskil and I listen to music in the writing room all the time. We sit together most of the time when we create the script. And then there's a moment at the end where Eskil writes out scenes that we've agreed on and I edit a bit, but we're in the room most of the time for a year at least. And we listen to music. Hmm. We try to capture the mood of the piece through music. So it's sometimes we know specific songs will fit here or there, or it's a matter of like, oh, well, you know, I'm a DJ too, by the way. So I care a lot about different music traditions, and it's completely schizophrenic in this film. But as an example, we knew that there was the Antonio Carlos Jobim Brazilian classic Waters of March that we had found a fun Art Garfunkel version of.
Yeah,
which is from like mid-70s, 1975 album called Breakaway.
Yeah.
And Art Garfunkel, this is beautiful. And we thought, what if this could be the end of the film? You know, that was an idea I had early. Like, and it is now. We actually got that song to be the end of the film. A stick, a stone, it's the end of the road. It's the rest of a stump. It's a little alone. It's a sliver of glass. It is life. It's the sun. It is night. It is death. It's a trap, it's a gun. The oak when it blooms, a fox in the brush, the knot of the wood, the song of a thrush, the wood of the wing, a cliff, a fall, a scratch, a lump. It is nothing at all. It's the wind blowing free. It's the end of a slope. It's a beam, it's a void, it's a hunch, it's a hope. And the riverbank talks of the waters of Mars. It's the end of the strain, it's the joy in your heart. So we had those moments, but also like the whether it would be Sumande that they put on or some boogie funk tune from the early 80s, or like what exactly a guy in his 40s is gonna put on when he wants to dance. Time has been lost for trying.
It's
I could have millions of ideas about that, you know. So it was about trying to find something that was kind of fun and hip for that generation, as opposed to Amarie, as you say, which is Julie grew up with a lot of 80s R&B, I'm sure. No, sorry, 90s. And yeah. So that would be like the perfect or early 2000s for her generation. You know, so I'm trying to be both character specific, but also just put music in there that emotionally I love. You know, presenting tunes is a part of the fun of making movies. Well, which is an all-time favorite of mine. And now sitting out in LA doing this interview, I'm thinking about him all the time. Sort of the LA vibe. And Todd Rundgren is another favorite.
Yeah. So It's
an album called Healing, which is remarkable that he has done. And yeah, anyway, so tons of music, jazz, classical, all kinds of things.
Beautiful Billie Holiday, the way you look tonight as well is gorgeous. That's so beautiful.
Yes,
when she's moving in with accent.
Yeah, that's also a very, very trying to generally for this film find music that has joy, but also melancholy. Like that mixes the vibe I'm after in this film. That it has both. And the way you look tonight is the perfect. It sets the mood completely to me.
Cheeks so soft, there is nothing for me but to love you just the way you look tonight.
That's, I'm very grateful for being allowed also to use these songs. It's damn expensive. And our Goran Ubad, who is our music supervisor, has just done a great job collecting all of the stuff and managing all the contracts.
There's a lot of music. There is a lot of music, but it works so well. And even sort of that little scene where the Amarie track and then Samand. And I love that kind of use of music sort of diegetically, but then also not, and how you, the shot from outside the cabin almost, and they're all dancing and you can sort of hear the music for a few seconds and then just before that, but it's all muted almost in a way. And then the light shade incident happens as well. It's got lovely texture to it as well that just really immerses you in the film even more so, I think.
Thank you. No, I care a lot about sound. I grew up, my father was a jazz musician when he was young, but he's also a sound designer in movies and a sound recorder even. So I was on set a lot as a child, sitting next to the person who got the sound. And in my films, there's always like 100% sync recorded sound for all dialogue. We really fight hard to create situations so we can capture it. There's no post sync unless maybe one line or two for narrative reasons. But no, the performance and the sound of the human voice in that moment needs to be the one that we got on set, you know. And I shoot on 35, so even the camera is sometimes a little bit noisy, and you know, we're so sound and music matters a lot to movies. And I like to watch movies in a theater. You know, I make my films for the big screen, even though I know more people will watch them at home, and that's fine too. But I really try to get the balance of that sound emotion thing right.
It's also an important decision to know when not to use music or not to overpower it with. And there's that lovely moment where Julie's sitting on the, she's sitting on the bench looking out, and it, and there's nothing. And then the Chasuble piece comes in, Water, Voices and Snow. I almost stopped breathing for a minute, kind of thing, just kind of, and it's just, it's, yeah, it's so beautifully constructed.
I'm a big fan of Chassola, the French musician, pianist, composer, genius, you know. I love him, and I met him a couple of times, and he's amazing. And but it's, the music is also so powerful in itself, and that, just as you said very accurately, you got to be cautious, you know. If you ramp up the music, you drown the image. It needs to counter. It needs to come in a little bit later than you think, and maybe not at the volume you expect. Or, you know, I we're all, of course, super fans of Hans Zimmer and, you know, the great Hollywood composers. But when I saw Dune, I was like, my God, you know, there's many, many great things I could say about that film. But I just think that there's such, like, the music is so, there's so much of it and so loud. And I was like, oh, I had to see this a second time to really experience it. It becomes, maybe it's me being too sensitive, but it's so much. We're used to movies flaunting their great musical work to such extent at all the time. And we're raised in that tradition, and I completely respect it. I wouldn't be able to do it because it takes a certain skill I don't have. So again, it's not to say anything bad about it, but I come from a different school. I need silence because it structures my narrative. I need to come down and then build up again. That's the way I tell stories. And we all do this differently. But for me, that's very important.
How much, in terms of making the film as well, you know, how much did the film, did you shoot what you needed in terms of, or did you, you know, there are some, everyone works differently in terms of, in the edit, kind of, it took on a slightly different form, or we had to cut this or whatever and stuff. What's your kind of process with that? I mean, I think it's just because I'm hankering after, you know, extra scenes that weren't in there, because I need more of her. I need more of the story.
Yeah, no, thank you. I there's a lot of scenes that didn't make it into the final cut. And we kind of knew for this one that was going to be the way, because it has that fragmented structure of chapters and moments and moving through large areas of someone's life. You know, we're actually watching several years play out. There's a Criterion Blu-ray coming out with a few extra scenes that are going to be on it. So there's like a scene I'm very, very proud of that we had in the middle, which is a SMS split screen scene that we came up with, where Julie and Axel haven't spoken for a while, and there's sort of a complex time lapse structure where we watch them in a split screen sequence live their lives in the correspondence of a text messaging correspondence of like, she needs books, she'd forgotten his flat. And he really gets very excited. She's in touch, but then she doesn't answer when he expects to, and he gets hurt. And it's like seeing that back and forth of how hard it is to be ex-partners and trying to communicate about simple things. Ultimately, we didn't put it in the film because we needed him to completely leave the story for a while for them to return with more of an emotional urgency. But that
it floors
piece,
you.
That middle piece that we took out, I am very proud of it as a scene. It's like a short film in itself. So that's going to be out there on the Blu-ray. But I shoot more than I need. And I think that's a luxury that makes for better movies. You know? And I wouldn't be able to work that way when I was younger for financial reasons. But now I have people around me, producers, that understand that is a bit of the process. We got to be taking a chance with some of this material.
Did Renata's performance influence any choices on music? Because she embodies that character. I mean, you kind of, it's just an incredible performance, I think, you know, in terms of it's so truthful. Did her performance, it's interesting when I sometimes speak to composers, Nicholas Britell was a great example where when he worked on If Beale Street Could Talk, and he talks about Regina King's character particularly.
Beautiful work. Oh my God, that's such beautiful.
And he said that if it had been a different actor in that role, the score would have been different because he wrote specifically for her performance. And I wondered whether Renata's performance, if it informed any choices for you with regards to the music and stuff, because they feel so, you know, they feel like they could be part of her, you know, on her device that she listens to music, or they're part of her world or what she would listen to. Or like you mentioned, the A. Marie thing would be something that she would be familiar with or whatever. But I wondered if it went that far, where her performance informed any of those choices for you.
I think that's a great question. And I think in a way you answered it. Yes, this is exactly the balance. Her performance will defined everything as I come into the editing room, and Anders' performance and Herbert Nordrum's performance, like all of them, because we will cut words a lot because we don't need them on set. And Eskil, Fokt, and me as writers, we love that. We feel, okay, the intention of the scene is better without those words. We'll drop them. We're not very precious about the actual wording usually. So the same goes in the edit, like, oh, we thought we would build this scene up with a strong song like that. And actually, we just need silence because I don't want to touch this. This moment was perfect, the way that Renata, for example, did it. So it's a balancing act of always on set, always in the edit, always in the mix, being awake, alert to what is at play and not losing it.
Yeah.
That's the clue. It's so easy to put something on top of something else. And suddenly, I'll give you another example that we don't talk about enough, color grading. We shoot on 35 because a lot of the skin tones, the complexity of faces matters to me. Mm-hmm. So for example, in the grading, if you want to do, so we're always cautious of magenta, red, for example. If I shoot a lot of white walls and light is messy and suddenly it's either blue or red, and we try to balance and we find neutrality, which is like a virtue, I think, in balancing a good exposed image, a clear white in the middle of it somewhere. That's always like a good place to think about it. Suddenly I realized, oh my God, we've taken out some red and Renata's skin tones, she's blushing. Maybe she's tearing up, not quite crying, and the red in her eye has disappeared. And suddenly we're muting the performance through the color grading. So everything matters. You got to be very aware. And Julien Allary, our colorist, is very aware of this. Like, it's humanist cinema. It's about human beings and feeling them and being close to them and seeing what the actors reveal to us that maybe is hidden for the people around them in the same room in the scene. But we need to see it. We need to feel that intimacy of sometimes loneliness of someone at the dinner party, like in the film, we're seeing something that the others aren't seeing. And if we mute the colors, suddenly some of the performance is lost. So sound, color grading, all that stuff is based on the performance.
Yeah. I think that you've also captured the most honest breakup sex scene I've ever seen as well. I think that whole... you're like, oh, don't do it. We've all been there. It's kind of, it's that kind of thing of the, you just don't want to let go. But you know, it's so emotional. It's such a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful watch. And I'm so glad that the film's, you know, it's getting recognized and it's coming out in cinemas, and I'm so excited for people to to go and see it in cinemas. I kind of like this kind of weird, slightly sadistic thought of going away. It'd be quite nice to just kind of go out for a night out with, get some of your ex-boyfriends together and go out and watch the film together. Just put everything to pass and just kind of, you know, you know, this is a good way just to go, I'm sorry, you're sorry, let's just, you know.
I love that. I think that would be awesome. I know for a fact that several people have told me that they got in touch with their exes after having seen the film. I hope that was a good thing. Not necessarily that people re-engaged with their exes in a romantic sense, but at least trying to like have closure or say, hey, you matter to me. A big theme in the film is that all of these fragments that we think are passing moments.
Yeah.
And life hasn't quite yet begun, has it? You know, these are just things that I'm going through now before the real thing happens. Those things are the big components of life. Those are the building blocks of our history. These are the, maybe that relationship you thought was not so important is actually the one where you learn the most to realize who you are or what you need. And so that's a part of the story. So yeah, if people can resolve some ex-partner issues, great.
Whilst watching a fantastic film. Listen, I wish you all the success this weekend as well. And I'm excited to see what's next. Do you have the next project kind of, you know, in some shape or form, I hope, or even in your head?
We're going to, you know, we haven't had much time because the film has had such a wonderful journey and we've traveled with it. But so Eskil and I are going to go in back into the writing room actually in a couple of weeks and start writing on the next one. I'm the kind of filmmaker that work. I've written 5 films with Eskil and I've directed 5 films. I don't have any scripts that I haven't made. And I'm very proud about that. And I don't say that in an arrogant way. It's rather that I fight for the personality of each project to kind of to be what it needs to be without developing 100 different things. So that's what we're going to continue to do.
Amazing. Well, thank you for The Worst Person in the World and for the therapy as well. I feel like I got with it. And the amazing soundtrack. It's such a treat to get to chat to you. And I hope we can do it on the next project too.
Oh, I would love to. Thank you for having me.
Take care. Bye-bye. Good luck this weekend.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye. I said goodbye to me. I looked in the mirror. Then I began to cry. I leave my things behind for all to see and hope that she will understand why. Ending the game is like changing the name of your favorite song. Step out of rhyme for the very first time. And the song is gone. I said goodbye to me. I looked in the mirror and I began to cry. I leave my things behind for all to see. And hope that she understands. From the soundtrack to The Worst Person in the World, that's I Said Goodbye to Me by Harry Nilsson, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with Joachim Trier. My huge thanks to Joachim for taking the time to talk to us. You can watch his film in cinemas now, The Worst Person in the World. And despite falling short at the Oscars, it really was worthy of its nomination in the Best Foreign Film category. And once again, my huge thanks to you for listening. We really are incredibly proud to have made 300 episodes of this podcast with some of the best filmmakers, composers, musicians, screenwriters and talents and creatives on the planet. And we're going to continue doing that for as long as we can, because we'll be back next week, as always, with episode 301. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.